Welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Dr. Michael Mulkenton. Michael is a teacher and historian with a particular interest in aviation and air power. Michael's first book was Fire in the Sky, the Australian Flying Corps in the First World War, published in 2010. His latest book and first biography is Anzac and Aviator, the remarkable story of Sir Ross Smith and the 1919 England to Australia air race. Michael, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bill.
Michael, Sir Ross Smith packed a lot into his 29 years in the early 20th century. I think he's the ideal of a real Australian hero. How would you describe him?
I would agree with that, certainly. I think he was a pioneer, and he was the son of a pioneer as well. I mean, his father managed what was, in the early years of the 20th century, the largest sheep grazing station in South Australia. He came from pioneers, and then he became really, I think, I say in the book, Australia's first great aviation pioneer, you know, someone who came before Sir Charles Kingsford Smith, Bert Hinkler, and a number of our other later pioneer aviators who arguably are better known today than Ross Smith is.
And I wonder why that would be. I mean, I know there's an exhibition on at the South Australian State Library at the moment, a six-month exhibition. You know, I remember him from school days, but just the names, but not particularly what they did. Is there some reason why they're not as well known as, say, Kingsford Smith and Bert Hinkler even?
Yeah, it's a curious thing, really, isn't it? I mean, I was surprised when I first started researching him to learn that the last book that was written on Ross Smith really was a double biography done of him and his older brother Keith back in 1969. You know, so it's 50 years ago. It was written by a family friend, and it's a fairly insubstantial biography, really. And yet there's this incredibly rich collection of papers, private papers, diaries, hundreds of pages of letters that Ross wrote to his family and friends during his brief life. I mean, really all you need to write what I think, you know, what I predicted would be a very, very interesting biography to read. So it is a bit puzzling as to why he hasn't received more recognition lately. I mean, early on, after the flight that he made from England to Australia in 1919, he was world famous. He was certainly the most famous Australian in the world at the time in the years following the First World War. But I think a couple of things coalesced probably to make his legacy relatively short-lived, at least in the popular imagination. And one of those is that he died relatively soon after his great achievement. In 1922, he was killed in an accident while testing an aircraft, preparing actually to fly around the world. And, you know, it seems like he was remembered quite fondly, particularly in South Australia, for the next few decades. But I think as the generation that knew him personally began to pass on, so did his memory. The other thing, Bill, I think, is just the curse of the name Smith. Yeah, not only is it a very common name, but unfortunately for Ross, he shares that name with the other great famous Australian aviator named Smith, Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. And in fact, I can attest to that because in the 4 years that I was researching and writing this book, I regularly had well-meaning family and friends come up to me and say, "How's the Kingsford Smith book going?"
Yeah.
And I'd have to say politely, "Well, actually, it's the book's going well, but actually, it's not about Kingsford Smith. It's about another Smith that that was a great Australian aviation pioneer."
Well, yes, and he had in his personal life, he from what you say, he had a great modesty and a distaste for adulation. It's interesting you mentioned the year 1969 because it in my mind, it compared with Neil Armstrong after his moon mission that he was a little bit similar in that way.
Yeah, look, that analogy has been made, certainly, because the last year, of course, has been the centenary of the great flight. In fact, even as we speak now, there's a flight occurring across Australia involving a number of aircraft, essentially recreating the final stages of the great flight from England, which involved flying from Darwin all the way down to Adelaide. There has been a number of things done, I suppose, to mark the centenary. And as part of that, I have heard that analogy used a number of times of this essentially being the 1919 equivalent of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, you know, a new frontier. And I suppose in some ways it was, because in 1919, aircraft were an existing technology. They developed incredibly rapidly during the 4 years of the First World War, but they certainly hadn't done any intercontinental flying by the end of the First World War. And the great question that sort of, I suppose, came up at the end of the war was, well, there's this new technology here. How is it going to now be used in peacetime? And companies, governments, individual pilots turned with great enthusiasm and great energy to that very question. And in 1919, besides the Ross and Keith Smith flight to Australia, there were other flights as well that year. There was a flight across the Atlantic. There was a flight from London to Cape Town across the African continent. So this was very much the age, the era of the beginning, the dawn of intercontinental aviation. And indeed, it was a new frontier. It was taking the technology and it was pushing it out beyond what it could previously do. I suppose, in a sense, just like was happening in the late 60s with the space race.
Now, at school, Ross was a sportsman and a leader, and he had a solid family background, but his post-school career was, I think, as a warehouseman. At least for Ross Smith, I think you say war was the making of him.
Yeah, it's one of the fascinating things that I found when researching him. I mean, when we go to his papers now, or when we go and look at his childhood through the surviving records, we know what happens. We know that he becomes a war hero. You know, he's a highly decorated fighter pilot during the First World War and a great light horseman before that. We know that he goes on to make this epoch-making flight from England to Australia in 1919. But, of course, at the time, that none of that was guaranteed. And I suppose in writing a biography, one of the things that I found most fascinating was just seeing the way that contingency worked in an individual's life and the number of instances when Ross Smith's life could have taken a dramatically different direction, one that would have led him well away from aviation. Yeah, the fact that he, after school, goes and works for Harris Scarfe in South Australia in Adelaide, I think is an indication of that. And, of course, we don't know what would have happened had the war not started or had he not enlisted, but every indication seems to suggest that he would have lived a fairly unremarkable life and certainly one that wouldn't have, you know, come to much attention with future historians and so on.
Some 416,000 Australians enlisted for World War One. I think something like 38% of the male population between 18 and 44. Why do you think there was this rush to enlist?
Well, when we look at Ross's childhood, we can see that, although he probably wouldn't have realised it at the time, from a very young age, he and his peers were being conditioned to go and fight a war just like this. I mean, they were raised on the fringes of the British Empire, you know, rural South Australia. But at the same time, they were raised to see themselves as part of the British Empire. They were raised in a society that venerated military service and saw it not, I suppose, as we might today, as a career, but they saw military service as a civic duty. In the years before the First World War, Australia had a tiny permanent forces army. I think there were only about 2,000 personnel in our permanent forces army before 1914. The vast majority of Australian defence before the First World War was provided by part-time volunteers, essentially what we might sort of describe today as the Army Reserve. And Ross was part of that. He joined that coming out of school. And, I mean, as a young boy, he served in the cadets. He even went on a tour overseas around Britain as part of the cadets. And he later writes about how that experience convinced him that if Britain was ever in trouble, if Britain ever faced a war, that he had made his mind up that he was going to enlist straight away, which indeed is what he does. I mean, he's in the very first contingent to enlist. I think it's about 8 or 9 days after the declaration of war, he and his brother and a couple of mates go down to the enlistment office at Morfettville Racetrack and they try and sign up. And Ross is accepted straight away. Some of his friends aren't, but he's taken straight away. And he's in many ways just the sort of man that authorities were looking for the new Australian Imperial Force. He was young. He'd been to a private school. He had experience in the cadets and the militia, and he was very fit. He was very athletic and a great sportsman. So, yeah, he was snapped up very quickly.
Well, he initially went into the infantry, and he was in the light horse, I believe, but his first action was in Gallipoli. Of course, there were no horses there, were there?
No, that's right. And he was very eager to get into action. He was in Egypt, and the infantry were sent off for the initial landing, and he was very frustrated. He writes to his mother about his frustration that the light horse had to wait until he said shelters could be built for the horses, but obviously he had no idea of the terrain at Gallipoli. There's no way they were going to have mounted troops operating there at all. But essentially, the light horse were then sent within about a fortnight of the initial landing to be reinforcements, essentially, for the infantry and the light horse for that campaign. And Ross spends 5 months on Gallipoli, but he's never with a horse. It's essentially acting as the dismounted infantry.
When he did eventually get into the flying corps, what were the planes like then? When, you know, it's only a few years since the Wright brothers had the very first flight, say 1910, and there he was flying in the First World War. But the planes were pretty primitive, weren't they?
Yeah. So Ross joins the fledgling Australian Flying Corps in 1916. So I suppose you could say right about in the middle of the war. And at that time, aircraft are kind of in a transitional phase. In the very early days of the war, aircraft had been sent to the front to essentially act as an adjunct to the cavalry, to gather reconnaissance, to take photographs, and to report on enemy dispositions, as well as try and keep in touch with friendly forces. In 1915, however, and leading into 1916, aircraft begin to play more of a direct role in the fighting. So aircraft begin other roles, such as bombing and attacking targets on the ground. A very, very important role is cooperating with the artillery. So most of the artillery fire in First World War battles is indirect. So the gunners are firing at targets that they can't see on the ground. So they need observers. And of course, aircraft provide an excellent platform for that kind of observation. So these other roles are emerging in 1915 and 1916. So when Ross joins the Flying Corps in 1916, it's becoming quite a versatile and important arm. It's still relatively small, and the aircraft that they're flying essentially are two types. There's single-seat fighters, which are starting to emerge as a specialist aircraft designed solely to fight other aircraft, to destroy other aircraft. And then there's the two-seat aircraft that are more for reconnaissance and artillery cooperation roles. Now, in the Middle East, where Ross is, he's in Palestine, late 1916, the Sinai Desert, Palestine border area. When he joins the Flying Corps, the squadron he joins are essentially a two-seat reconnaissance squadron. And so the early roles that he's doing is taking photographs, it's gathering intelligence, and it's cooperating with the artillery. And initially, he doesn't join as a pilot. He wants to be a pilot, but he's initially accepted as an aerial observer. So he sits in the second seat and operates the camera or the Morse code button. But it's only about 6 months of that, and early 1917, he goes off to pilot training.
And we're speaking today with Dr. Michael Mulkenton, who is the author of an exciting new book called Anzac and Aviator, the remarkable story of Sir Ross Smith and the 1919 England to Australia air race. We might take a short break now, and as usual, we've asked our guest, Michael, you've picked a song for us.
Yes, it was a difficult decision. I really do like music. I like seeing live music, but an album I've been enjoying Bruce Springsteen's Western Stars, and I think my favourite song off that is Tucson Train.
I got so down and out in Frisco, tired of the pills and the rain. I picked up headed for the sunshine. I left the good thing behind. Seemed all of our love. coming in on the Tucson train. I come here looking for a new life, one I wouldn't have to explain. And that voice that keeps me awake at night, when a little piece would make everything right. If I could just turn off my brain. But now my baby's coming in on the Tucson train. We fought hard over nothing. We fought till nothing remained. I've carried that nothing for a long time. Now I carry my operator's license and spend my days running this train. My baby's coming in on the Tucson train.
We're dads on the air.
And that was Tucson Train by Bruce Springsteen, and that was the special choice today by our guest, Dr. Michael Mulkenton. Michael, we were just talking about the war exploits of Sir Ross Smith. After the war, he suddenly found that he wasn't living in the moment anymore, and he was facing a quieter life. So I guess it was about that time he started thinking about a flight from England to Australia.
Yeah, before I mentioned, you know, the interesting role that contingency, or I suppose some people might say luck or fate, that plays in the life of an individual. And we certainly see that at the end of the war with Ross Smith. I mean, in many ways, he happens to be in the right place at the right time with just the right set of skills to have an opportunity offered to him. So he's in Palestine at the end of the war. Towards the end of the war, he was given command of the only multi-engine bomber that the RAF operated in the Middle East. It was a giant aircraft, Handley Page 0400. And a couple of generals, British RAF generals in the Middle East, wanted to fly that aircraft from Cairo across the Middle East to Calcutta on an inspection tour of RAF bases. And given that Ross was the most, indeed one of the only experienced pilots on that type of aircraft in the region, they asked him to fly them across the Middle East to India, which he did. And from there, from India, Ross and one of the generals came up with the idea that perhaps they could fly all the way to Australia. The problem, of course, though, was that between Calcutta and Darwin, right across Southeast Asia, there were practically no airfields. There was practically no aviation infrastructure. So to begin with, they would need to survey a route, pick out some landing grounds, organise fuel supplies to be dropped off at various places, essentially map out the route before they could then come back and fly it. And in the early months of 1919, this is exactly what Ross and one of these British generals end up doing, and a couple of Ross's mechanics. They sail all the way across Southeast Asia, and they get about as far as Timor before they come back to India, ready to fly to Australia. But when they arrive in India, they realise their aircraft, that multi-engine bomber that they'd flown from Cairo, had actually been destroyed in a storm. So their plans at that point were foiled, and it looked like Ross was just going to have to return to Australia and perhaps to the drudgery of Harris Scarfe's warehouse. After the aircraft was destroyed in India, he went back to England, and he'd heard that the Australian government was offering a £10,000 prize for the first flight from England to Australia. And you're right, one of the first things that he needed to do, essentially, was to pull a crew together. His brother Keith had enlisted later in the war. There's conflicting accounts about why he hadn't joined up earlier, but it seems that he was initially medically unfit, and later on he joined the British Royal Flying Corps. His brother had gained a lot of experience flying aircraft, multiple types of aircraft, in training squadrons during the war. He was an instructor, and then when Keith and Ross met up. I mean, they were very, very close, the two brothers. And they'd lost a younger brother in the war as well. He killed at Passchendaele in 1917. So at that time when they met up, they hadn't seen each other for over 4 years. Yeah, it must have been an incredibly emotional reunion. And Ross asked his older brother right away if he'd be the navigator on the flight to Australia. And this, while I understood this from a sentimental and emotional point of view, it did strike me as strange. When I went through Keith Smith's flying logbook from the First World War and his personal papers, it became evident to me that he had almost no training or experience in long-distance navigation. As a flight instructor, he did nearly all of his flying probably within sight of an airfield, and he'd never done any sort of specialist training in long-distance navigation. So I think Ross was taking a pretty big gamble by asking his brother then to navigate him all halfway around the world by air, including over many regions that had never been traversed by aircraft before.
Well, you described the difficulties they had on that flight. It certainly wasn't like settling into first class in, on a plane these days. You know, they had minus 14 degrees, had snow in the cockpit. They had short runways. I think at one stage they push off from the back fence and then they have to get over trees at the other end. It's an absolute adventure, the trip out to Australia, isn't it?
Yeah. They're flying in an open cockpit biplane made of timber, fabric and essentially piano wire. And the aircraft is a capable aircraft. It's probably the most capable long-distance aircraft in the world at the time. It's state-of-the-art, but certainly primitive, you know, to what we're used to today. The aircraft's actually still, people can still see it. It's been preserved at Adelaide Airport. But the real problem for them was the lack of landing grounds and the lack of resources and infrastructure, particularly between India and Australia. And yeah, they were using improvised clearings in the middle of jungles. They were landing on polo fields. In Singapore, they landed on the racetrack. You know, and there were so many instances, Bill. It is extraordinary how many moments they came within, you know, a whisker of complete disaster. Mm. Taking off at Calcutta, for example, they flew through a flock of birds, and one of them nearly smashed the propeller. You know, at another point, they'd been told they could. There was a good airfield for them to use at Singora in what we now would call Thailand. And they arrived there and found that the airfield was not only waterlogged and flooded under a foot of water in places, but it was covered in tree stumps. But without petrol, they just had to land and miraculously missed every single tree stump except for one that tore the back skid off the aircraft, which they then had to repair. I mean, there were just so many extraordinary moments. And also, I should add that the flight across Australia, which they arrived in Darwin in December 1919, just in time, 28 days, just in time to claim the £10,000 prize, but then wanted to fly across the continent down to Melbourne, potentially onto Adelaide, which they did as well. And that was, in some ways, the most difficult part of the journey, because by then the aircraft was well and truly worn out. They had endless trouble with the engines, and they really narrowly made it across Australia. And again, at a time when there were very few airfields in Australia, certainly in regional Australia, and they were really blazing a trail in terms of our early aviation history there.
Because of their contract with Vimy for the plane, Ross wasn't able to complain or talk even about the mechanical problems they'd had. It all had to be all sunshine, didn't it, on the performance of the plane?
It did, yeah, and which is an interesting thing when we read the papers, because, you know, in public we've got Ross saying in, say, newspapers and in public speeches, Ross essentially saying things like, you know, we could jump back in the aircraft and fly back to Britain, you know, tomorrow. And he's doing that because, of course, he's acting as an agent for the Vickers company that supplied him with the aircraft. So he's being, I suppose, a good employee or a good endorsee there. But in the private correspondence, you know, he's writing to close friends, or he's writing to Vickers itself, he's listing this litany of mechanical problems that they're having. And it creates a difficult situation for him, because publicly he said, we're going to fly all the way to Adelaide. But increasingly that looks less and less likely, and it prompts him essentially to take some incredible risks, particularly towards the end of the flight. And over Adelaide, right near the end of the journey, for example, one of the engines fails and they nearly lose a propeller. And if that had happened, you know, that would have been catastrophic, almost certainly. They would have all been lost and would have been quite a tragic end to the flight. But miraculously, perhaps, they get the aircraft back to Point Cook in Melbourne, where they hand it over to the Australian government as a gift from the Vickers company, and that's the end of the flight. You know, it gets wheeled into a hangar and it hasn't flown since.
Well, that arrival in Adelaide, it reminded me of the Beatles arriving in 1964. It was just an extraordinary outpouring from the whole city, wasn't it?
But that was something that really surprised me, Bill, when I was reading about. I think looking at these, you know, the reception they had in Brisbane first, then in Sydney, in Melbourne, and certainly in Adelaide, which is, of course, their hometown. I mean, I think it potentially is the first example of mass public hysteria over, you know, over a visiting celebrity. Reading Ross's private letters to close friends during that period, you really get a sense as well of how difficult he found that. As you've mentioned before, he was quite unassuming. He didn't like attention. He was embarrassed by attention. And so when he had the attention of the whole world, he actually found that very difficult to deal with. And it had a bad effect on him personally, and it had a bad effect on his health as well.
We're speaking today with Dr. Michael Mulkenton, who is the author of this exciting book, Anzac and Aviator. It's full of daring do, I think is the old word for it, but wonderful stories, and it's a fantastic read, so thoroughly recommend it. But we've come to the end of the program, Michael. Unfortunately, I could swap stories with you all day about that you've written about Ross Smith and his brother Keith and the two mechanics who hardly ever get a mention. But look, it's a wonderful story, and thank you very much for being a guest on the program today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I hope people enjoy the book.
Yeah, look, and let's hope it leads on to some more research into the life of the Smith brothers. We'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you've got any comment on this particular program, and if you'd like to listen to the show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.